Welcome everyone to this next instalment of the UKIS ITEL podcast, and my guest today is none other than Ben Anselm. Anyone who's on Twitter will know Ben already, but he's Professor of Comparative Democratic Institutions at the University of Oxford. It's a slight sinking feeling I have about this podcast because Ben writes so much about so much. A, I'm profoundly jealous, and B, it's hard to know where to start, except he's got a new book out called Why Politics Fails. So, Ben, welcome.
Thank you, Anand, for having me. Let me do my customary book wave for the people who watch IKIS UTEL. Is it IKIS UTEL?
UKIS ITEL. Okay. UKIS ITEL. That's a great start.
Yeah, good. The book is also broad. So I do write about a lot of issues in contemporary British politics, and maybe we can come on to those later. But the book was an attempt by me to boil down a lot of big issues that Anand and I and other political scientists have to talk about all the time across a whole variety of domains to get to a core question, which is why is it so hard to get the kind of policies and get the outcomes that most of us think we agree on. And so the way that I structure the book is to say there are things that we all broadly agree on. So we would all like a democracy that that gives us some form of self-government, where what the people want somehow becomes the policy that we get. We would all like to be somewhat equal in the sense that most of us recoil at a kind of Oliver Twist world in which there's just a few with a lot of money and everybody else doesn't have any. We'd all like, if we got sick, to be looked after. We'd all like to be safe on our streets. And we would all like to, have as much or more as our parents or grandparents. And so these are sort of five big things: democracy, equality, solidarity, security, and prosperity. Those are the kind of part headers for each of the books, each of the sort of sets of chapters in the book. And then the book is really about, well, why is it so damn hard to get there? Why do we struggle? And at the core of the book then is a kind of common theme, which is, we're the problem. We're the problem, each of us as individuals, because these are big collective goals, but they can all be undermined by each of us either misrepresenting what we want or misbehaving in some way. And that plays out differently in each of these areas. But ultimately, those are really core problems to being a human. Right? So I've described the book in some places as a bit of political therapy. Right? So a good therapist, and there are lots of bad therapists, but a good therapist will get you to look inside yourself and think about, are the problems that I'm facing in part because of the behaviours that I have? And are there things I could do to know more about why I do that? And this is a political science version of that. Right? What are the things that each of us keeps on doing that makes it really hard to get to the goals that we want? I don't have a final answer to this, because I think it's really, really hard to come up with a solution that solves politics. But then the book looks at a series of different institutions or norms we could follow that help us get a bit closer to those goals.
I mean, I have to say I recoil at Oliver Twist because I never understood the point of people singing at each other rather than talking at each other. I just don't get musicals. But anyway, that's just me and my bitterness. But
you realise, Anand, that it was a book before it was a musical.
Yeah. But I'm very modern. I went straight to the musical. But you talk about a number of traps.
Yeah.
Can we start with those? Can you just sort of outline what you mean by these traps? I should say that the book is a great read on a number of levels, one of which is if you're interested in what political economy is, it's perhaps the best introduction to that I've ever read. But talk to us about these traps and why they exist and what they are.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's a very kind thing to say, because it was actually what I was trying to do with the book initially, was to think there are lots of books out there that give you a kind of guide to, say, behavioural economics. There's Thinking Fast and Slow and Behaviourally Irrational. Yeah. Or there's, books about popular psychology. Paul Dolan and people have books about that. But there isn't one about political economy. I thought that was unfortunate, because it's a set of fairly simple theories that draw across political science and economics that are all about what we call the collective action problem. Right? And the collective action problem is essentially when you do what is individually best for you, just seeking to do the best you can in the situation that you've been put in, but everybody collectively doing that somehow gives us less. And the example I draw on, and is the classic example in this literature, is fishing in the Atlantic. And I talk about
Cod Wars.
The Cod Wars, that's right. The only war that violates the democratic peace theory. Although, you know, there was one sort of accidental death, but there were people, you know, going around on boats with machine guns in the North Atlantic. Yep. And the reason was because Iceland was trying to expand its sort of proprietary fishing area into areas where British fishermen had fished. The problem for this was that there are plenty more fish in the sea, but there aren't infinite fish in the sea. And so the further the Icelandic fishermen sailed out, the more fish they caught the British fishermen couldn't get. So they were doing what was individually rational for them. The collective problem was that it wasn't possible in the North Atlantic to monitor people, to draw a line and figure out who owned what part of the sea and then enforce that. Just not possible with the technology of the day then, or really with the technology of the day now. And so everybody then just ended up overfishing and depleting the North Sea cod stocks. And so that's your bad collective outcome that comes from everybody doing something individually rational, but in a world where we can't really draw up enforceable treaties or enforceable contracts. And that's what politics is, right? We can't draw up enforceable contracts. So the examples I like to give on this are Jeremy Corbyn offered free broadband for everybody in the 2019 general election. Okay, well, we'll never know what would have happened. But imagine a world in which Jeremy Corbyn had failed to give everybody free broadband. You could not have gone and sued the Labour Party and said, where's my free broadband had this not happened? Right? There was no contract between you and the Labour Party. You could do that, right? If you bought broadband from Virgin Media, you could sue them. But you can't do that in politics. So voters don't have a complete contract with politicians. And imagine that he'd come into power in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And then he had done something that the Liberal Democrats hadn't liked and they'd left. He couldn't sue the Liberal Democrats to make them stay in a coalition. Right? Again, in politics, nobody stands behind you. So it's those kinds of difficulties that we all face in political life where there's no backstop. There's no one who's going to come in and bash heads and say, you've all got to do this. And that's where the collective action problem is really pervasive.
I mean, on that, actually, just I'm aware of the danger of me going off at tangents because there's so much to talk about here. Is it possible to regulate against political dishonesty? It is, isn't it? I mean, there are some parts of the world that have tried to sort of punish political lies. So in that sense, you know, one thing is it worth thinking about ways of trying to hold politicians' feet to the fire more effectively through regulation?
Well, we do have a way of holding politicians' feet to the fire. It's called having elections after the fact, right? So we can exercise accountability.
That's very indirect, though, isn't it?
It is. And actually, this is one of the benefits of our system, which has all kinds of dilemmas that come from having a first-past-the-post system. But in a coalition government, it's really hard to know who to blame and who you would get mad at and therefore vote out of office. So that's really difficult. We could have some kind of truth commission. You can imagine with the way I've described it that might be quite controversial. So for a start, it's hard to know how, let's say you had the most honest broker of all and you gave them a kind of ombudsman and you said you have the right to overrule politicians and punish them. But ultimately the person who sets up the ombudsman is probably a politician and the person who can get rid of an ombudsman is also the politicians. So I guess in political life that there's no absolute ground that you can stand on and say, actually, this is an inviolable entity that can punish politicians, because ultimately we live in a world where politics is sovereign and going to pull the floor out from under that. And I think you can see that with the office, you know, the OMB or even the Bank of England, right? None of them can be sure that they're permanent. And we see this often with courts, as in, for example, Poland. Right? The courts can make rulings, or the Israeli courts, and the politicians can try and undermine the courts. And so I think we're always in this dance. And it's easier for us in the United Kingdom, where it's probably harder to get rid of institutions, but as we discovered with the prorogation of Parliament, it's not impossible.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was sort of thinking as I read the book, I mean, there's two things about the book that were striking. One is you bring in this host of examples from other eras and other countries, but two, in many ways, the analysis is very rooted in the UK first-past-the-post two-party system. And so, I mean, one obvious question is, I mean, let's confine ourselves to Europe for a moment. If you look around Europe, are there other countries that tackle these traps better? And if so, why?
So I think there are, and I do make the argument in the book that there are some big institutional solutions that help you resolve multiple traps at once, help you escape multiple traps at once. And, you know, the big one I talk about is proportional representation as an electoral system, which you're alluding to. And so you could argue that countries like Sweden and Denmark, and look, for social scientists, books always end with, oh, look at Sweden and Denmark, right? So I'm not doing anything original here. But I guess the argument I would make about why Sweden and Denmark and a number of other countries, you know, Northern European countries with PR systems have been successful, is not just that they have large welfare states. The reason that they have large welfare states that have some benefits in terms of equality and solidarity is because they have stability in government, and they have proportional representation systems that mean most people get a say at some point. And so they can develop state institutions that, yes, sometimes are larger than in the UK, but sometimes not. But the big difference, I think, is not size, but stability. So that you know what's going to happen from one year to the next. And stability is really crucial for investment, for security, for knowing that if you get ill in 10 years' time, roughly the same system will be there to look after you and so forth. So I think that's the real secret, is stability rather than, you know, than just spending.
I mean, but two things on that. And here, actually, I have to sort of give a hat tip to Alan Rennick at UCL. I went to his inaugural lecture the other day, which was fantastic. And you should all go to the Constitution Unit website and watch it if you get a moment. But he was talking about sort of trade-offs between first past the post and PR. And one of the things he said was, that's great. You might get better representation via PR, but actually where you suffer then is when it comes to accountability, which is it's harder to identify culprits. So in a sense, what we were just, you're sort of giving with one hand and taking away with the other. So it's not necessarily a panacea, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, ultimately, as a political economist, what I talk about all the time is trade-offs. So, you know, I'd like to think that there was some perfect solution, but there isn't. Not everything is a trade-off, right? So you can be bad at multiple things. And maybe we're beginning to enter that world in the United Kingdom now. You know, and people often look at, you know, Italy often gets, you know, called out for having both unstable politics and a stagnant economy, right? So for a while, you could have made the argument that the US and the UK had this very volatile political systems that led to kind of scorched earth policies, but they could be innovative and booming. So that was a trade-off. I think right now in the UK, we're sort of falling below on both measures, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And you could argue that, you know, some of the most successful PR countries get the best of both worlds. But again, you can also get stagnation. I think the accountability issue is really important. I still think it's not clear that our system has necessarily created the accountability we would like, because if you think about the kind of recreation that we've had over the last 13 years now of a prime minister from the same party, but it's been five different prime ministers from that same party. Yeah. And each time they sort of reinvent what they are and say, well, that's why you can ignore the previous person in my clothing. And so that makes, I think, accountability more tricky than it might appear. You know, if we're voting out Rishi Sunak, but the reason we're doing it is because we wanted to vote out Liz Truss or Boris Johnson, it's a form of accountability, but it's not ideal.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone claims any system is ideal. But I mean, one of the good things about the book, I suppose, is that you come up with solutions to these respective traps: democracy trap, equality trap, solidarity trap, security trap, prosperity trap. How practical do you think the solutions you're putting forward are? Because some of them involve some fairly major restructuring of institutions or the creation of new social norms.
Yes. Okay, so in general, the solutions in the book come in two flavours. They're either you create some form of political institution, and the way I think about institutions is as fossils, if you like, right? They're created to solve a problem at a period in time, but then they last onwards, and they probably become ever less functional. But they were created to make a promise between people to resolve a problem that couldn't be resolved. And so they probably do have functionality that we don't always see, right? So there is a slightly small C conservative aspect to this part of the book to say, be careful before you throw away all your institutions. They might be allowing people to align their expectations, or they might play a role that you're not aware of. And the other thing I talk about is social norms. Obviously, social norms, you can't see them. There are some fun examples in the book of, you know, having street mimes guiding traffic on the streets of Bogota to prevent road rage by sort of, you know, like Marcel Marceau pretending to be hit by cars that are going too fast to get a better norm of driving. I'm not sure that we could use mimes to resolve all of our problems, but, you know, it's quite a vivid idea. Norms are really hard to create. And it's true that we could employ an army of mimes. Maybe that would be a good way to solve unemployment problems, to enforce norms. But, you know, I think over, you know, at the end of the day, a norm is enforceable because everybody believes it and they punish people who don't abide by it. But we do have new norms. It's just politicians can't create them, right? So we have norms against racism and homophobia now that we didn't have in this country 30 or 40 years ago. Those are enforced by the general public, right? So the prime minister doesn't come in. Indeed, politicians prefer to pretend this isn't a problem for the most part. But we enforce it through society, right? So norms do emerge, but I agree they're hard for politicians to shift. Big institutional creation like proportional representation is also really hard. That's why it's in the concluding chapter in a, for the most right. part, right? Because that's the big fix. But you can do small fixes. And, you know, the great thing about writing a book for a broader market is your publishers will tell you, please think about solutions and don't just diagnose problems. Yeah. And so, you know, that's hard for academics, as you all know. And you run a think tank where you have to come up with solutions all the time. And so you must be going through permanent cognitive dissonance about this. but the types of examples I give are pretty small scale, right? So the examples I give for democracy are things like citizens' assemblies in Ireland. And so many of your listeners will know about the Irish citizens' assemblies that were created to help resolve what Ireland was going to do about abortion, is I think how I'll phrase that, right? So Ireland had banned abortion and had all of these pretty stark cases of mothers dying because they weren't allowed to have an abortion to save the mother's life. That was clearly perceived to be, you know, a step too far, but fully legalized abortion on demand was not going to happen either. And abortion is an area that where people have very strong polarized views, but there are also lots of moving parts, right? So what kinds of things do you allow exceptions for? How long can you have an abortion for? Can the abortion be through drugs? Can you have a morning after pill? So lots of moving parts. And the best way then of resolving that was to get everybody in the public into rooms to talk about all of these different issues and see if you could find some kind of center ground once everybody understood what all the issues were. So you just weren't revolving around and around and saying, well, what about this? What about that? And the language that was used in those citizens' assemblies, some Irish political scientists did some text analysis on it, and they compared it to the language used in the parliamentary committees in Ireland at the same time. And they found it was more complex from citizens and less negative. In other words, we are actually pretty good at this job if we're put in a room together. Now, citizens' assemblies aren't going to resolve every problem in Britain. I'm not sure an assembly for Brexit would have helped resolve our problems.
And often, we did indeed have one.
We did indeed have one, and it didn't resolve our problems. No. So I suppose that's one way of putting it. Politicians are only going to do this when they want to relinquish control because it's too hard. And I think that was true for abortion in Ireland. And also they're really, really expensive. Really, really, really expensive to do. So they're not a perfect solution, but, you know, that said, a fairly small country managed to resolve a really, really big problem with the citizens' assembly. So they're definitely not they're not too expensive, too difficult, and they can resolve some pretty big problems.
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Ora and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now. Are you at all concerned that in an age which has seen the UK feel very polarised, that we have fewer and fewer shared norms, and politicians in particular are willing to break what we thought of as unbreakable norms? Is that an issue when it comes to the sorts of things you're proposing? Is this a very bad context to be thinking in this way?
It's hard to know. If you break a norm, is it gone? Have you opened the seal on the bottle and the genie? Well, now I mix my metaphors, but have you let the genie out of this bottle? I don't know if the genie's sealed into the bottle. can you get the norm back in? And that's not clear. I think a whole variety of parliamentary norms were broken, and they weren't just broken by Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. They were also broken by John Bercow. arguably, in terms of the order paper with Brexit. So I think it is a challenging time. About 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer, my colleague Jane Gingrich and I, we wrote a textbook chapter for a comparative politics textbook in the United States. We did the case on the United Kingdom. And our theme was, why does this country without any rules seem to follow them? Right, it's a nice puzzle.
Yeah.
And of course, the argument was, in part, there are all of these norms of parliamentary sovereignty, of behaviour in Westminster that have been going for hundreds of years and people follow them, so they don't break them. There's also the European Union from above constraining, and then there's also a powerful opposition that can hold the government of the day to account, and then there's a vibrant civil society and media. I think during Brexit, all of those things became more tenuous, right? So obviously the European dimension was removed, the norms got broken, the opposition was ineffective and torn apart itself, and I'm now trying to remember what my final example here was of constraints. Oh, and the media and civil society was being directly attacked by government, right? So that became more contentious as well. So can we piece all those parts back together? Well, I think it will depend in part on having a strong opposition. Let's say Keir Starmer does become the next prime minister. Yeah. Will there be a strong opposition holding them to account? Will the opposition be ripping themselves into shreds? I think the National Conservatism Conference of the last few days suggests the opposition might be ripping themselves into shreds, but we'll see. I think the media and civil society have survived and still play that important role. And I think actually the re-engagement with negotiating with Europe will ultimately sort of enforce some rules from above as well. So then the question is, will Keir Starmer follow the rules of Parliament? And my guess is he's a pretty kind of rule-respecting individual given his career past.
I mean, everyone is till they get the top job. Anyway,
well, then that's the problem. No, absolutely.
All right, well, listen, firstly, everyone should buy the book. It's a tour de force. It covers so much. And even if you don't agree with it all, it'll get you thinking, as it certainly got me thinking. But I want to move on. Partly because, as I said, Ben has done so much. And I want to touch on a couple of things before we end. The first is technology. And there are a couple of things here. Firstly, I want you to talk about Taiwan, which you do in the book, because there's an app that they've used to help improve the quality of democratic politics. Can you just talk us through that? Because I thought that was fascinating and I didn't really understand.
Well, I'm not sure I understand exactly how the technology works, but let me give you my version of it. So Taiwan has this very innovative minister who introduced a app called VTaiwan. And the idea is a little bit like Ireland's Citizens Assemblies, but much cheaper because it's done online. The idea here is a bit like Reddit for people who use Reddit. I'm sure you've done an Ask Me Anything.
I didn't understand what I was doing, but yeah.
But there we go. Okay. So one of the nice things about Reddit is that people tend to add new comments all the time and upvote them or downvote them. It's also true in Reddit that you can reply to threads, right? So this is where VTaiwan changes. Imagine you have a contentious issue, but not super contentious, because the ones in Taiwan weren't super contentious. They were like, where should Uber operate, or can people buy alcohol online? And then what citizens were allowed to do is they were allowed to post a kind of policy suggestion, and then people could upvote it or downvote it. But what they couldn't do is reply. And you might think, well, that reduces democracy. But what it did, and anyone who spent any time on the football message board will know that streams of replies about, you know, whether we should, for example, keep Roy Hodgson in Crystal Palace, just go on forever. And then they just become flame wars of people kind of going back and forth. And you couldn't do that on VTaiwan. You could just put your own policy suggestion down afterwards. And that would be upvoted or downvoted as well. And then ultimately, the idea was that you sort of winnow through all these different ideas by following the ones with more upvotes. And so, yes, they were able to resolve that children shouldn't be able, you know, you had to present ID online somehow to buy alcohol and get it sent to you, and that Uber could operate under certain conditions or not. So that seems to me like a good way of getting citizens involved. I know from my own surveys that if you ask people to write a sentence justifying their ideas, they're much more complex and coherent than I think social scientists often give people the credit for. Mm-hmm. And we could extend that to more deliberative areas about policies. Again, the question is what policies, right? We're not going to resolve Brexit this way. We might be able to resolve some issues about, you know, who should pay for sewage in the Thames, I suppose. But we're going to have to figure out what kinds of places we could use this type of technique for.
No, it's interesting though, and I should also say Ben's Substack is well worth subscribing to. And on there, you'll find details of a general election app that he's designed that is intended to help us predict what would happen under certain under certain conditions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, UK Changing Europe very kindly 4 years ago allowed me to do an early version of this for the 2019 election, where we were trying to figure out what would happen with tactical voting. So I basically cranked out the old machine, but I've updated it. So you can go to this app if you go to benansel.substack.com. I think it'll be there in the first or second area, and then you'll have to link through to the actual to the app. But you can put in any current set or imaginary set of polling, and what it will do immediately for you is it'll tell you, okay, how would that translate into Westminster, excluding Northern Ireland? And I'm sorry about Northern Ireland, but I couldn't figure out how to get in polling levels for the DUP and so on. So it's got everywhere else. But then what you can do is you can shift voters around. So you can say, well, what if 30% of Lib Dem, Labour and Green voters will switch to back the party who did best in 2019 of those three parties? So if you like, where the Lib Dems came second, all the Labour and Green voters vote for them. And where Labour came second, all the Lib Dem and Green voters vote for them. And the Greens didn't come second anywhere, but imagine a world in which they did. And if you do that, what you discover very quickly is it's very hard for Rishi Sunak to have the largest party after the election. But it's also, ironically, makes Labour more likely to get a majority. And this is exactly what happened in 1997. There was an informal Lib-Lab pact. It was good for the Liberals in the sense that they won more seats, but it was bad for the Liberals in the sense that there was no way they were going to be in a coalition government because it made Labour's majority even bigger. And that's what you'll see if you do this. I've also added a new lever to it yesterday or the day before, where you can move reform voters to the Conservatives. See what would happen if Rishi does stop the boats and he gets reform voters to back the
Right,
Conservative
okay, yeah.
Party. Is there a way back for the Conservative Party? And the answer, of course, is it makes things better. But under current polling, it still makes it very, very challenging.
Interesting. Well, I've had a play and I recommend that you all do. And the final thing I want to talk about is housing. You've written a lot about the housing crisis we face in the UK. And in a sense, you've put forward both a very simple reason and a slightly more complex reason. The simple one is opposition to building new houses. And congratulations for shaping Keir Starmer's thinking, which you can explain to our listeners in a minute. And the more complicated trap is the prosperity trap. Can you just talk us through both briefly and give yourself a plug for shaping the leader of the opposition's words?
Thank you. Well, the person I should really thank is the Badger columnist at The Economist, Duncan Robinson, because he's the person who took my data and gave it the wonderful names of builders versus blockers. He and I had been speaking a week or two ago about this because I've run a series of surveys, three surveys, where I've asked people in the UK, do you want to build new houses? How do you feel about new houses being built in your local area? Right. Do you support that or oppose it? And so basically, the British public are split on this issue. 37% of them are support it, 39% oppose it. Everyone else is in the middle. As Duncan said to me, it's there aren't actually that many things in Britain where we're completely divided like that. Now, on immigration, you tend to find more people oppose it. On something like gay rights, we tend to find very strong support. This real kind of polarization of public opinion is unusual. And it makes it really, really hard to build new houses because there's a lot of people who are indifferent and the opposers are really, really concentrated. They find it easy to block building housing. You have the further problem that in any country where about two-thirds of people own houses, they have a vested interest in restraining supply to the degree that they think that building new houses will reduce the value of their house. And so all things go against it. It's a bit of a problem from hell for us. And so, what do I mean by this being part of Britain's prosperity trap? Because I have an article about that on my Substack. Prosperity traps emerge whenever the short-term costs of doing something loom larger than the long-term benefits. So even if the long-term benefits might outweigh them, we get caught on the short term either because we can't value the long run or because, and I think this is really important for housing, the people who are hurt in the short term in Britain from building housing are a concentrated group of people who are politically active, older, have had the governing party in power for the last 13 years and can see all the costs come immediately, right? So bulldozers going down the road, fields being dug up, and the people who benefit from new houses, by definition, don't live in them yet, right? So it's a diffuse group of people who won't be in them for a long time, and for whom the benefits of building new houses in the abstract now are basically houses might be cheaper a bit in 5 years, right? So that's a very diffuse nationwide thing. And that's a real mismatch in our politics, because it's very hard to get that latter group politically activated, and the former group are really strong. It's a bit like foreign trade, where the people who get hurt by trade are in factories that are closing down immediately, and the people who benefit are you and I buying, you know, cheaper shirts 5 years down the line. And those problems are always really, really hard to resolve, especially when they're all made, all the decisions that matter are made at the local level in this country because of our planning regime, where the people who are hurt live and can be politically active.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the housing crisis, isn't it? Because it has so many impact. I mean, there's the impact on your ability to live in a house, obviously, which is a serious one given levels of homelessness and the inability of people to get houses. But it seems to me there's two other things that we should talk about. I mean, the first is that relationship between income and wealth, and housing is responsible for so much accumulated wealth that isn't effectively taxed. And the third one is the labour market. You know, I remember the days under New Labour where people used to brag about the wonderfully flexible labour market. And you know, and I in Oxford, and I know here in London, that, you know, if your university wants to appoint a sort of mid-career academic who's in the University of Sheffield, it all goes swimmingly until they come down and try and find a place to live. And then it's like, doesn't work. So, I mean, the dysfunction in our housing market seems to affect so many aspects of our lives, but it just seems to be, I mean, you talk in the book about third rails. I mean, this seems a very third rail.
Absolutely.
Issue. I mean, yeah, do you see any prospect of it being addressed?
Well, Keir Starmer is actually stepping on the third rail right now, and I guess he's seeing how, you know, how much his hair stands up. And in a way, you might think, well, you know, there's lots of other things going on. You know, I was thinking yesterday, well, you know, he shows a bit of leg on proportional representation to really scare people. Well, on the other hand, doing this about housing, you know, you might say, oh, we'll do PR and that will really freak people out. And he say, well, we're not going to do that, but we'll still do the housing. So he's, you know, he's being a bit more ambitious, I think, and being a bit more daring. And it will be interesting to see. I think the Times, for example, was relatively supportive today. And that's a good kind of centre-right ground to get a sense of the kinds of people who normally would be nervous about their house prices going down. They were relatively supportive. So I think what we've seen on the right, one of the big splits in the Conservative Party that we're all aware of, is there is a group of Trussites. Simon Clarke is the really obvious one, who are deeply concerned about the British housing market. And that filters into the centre-right think tanks like the Centre for Policy Studies.
Yep.
So I think there's a group of people on the right who care about this. And, you know, as Duncan's article suggests and my academic work shows, the people who want to build houses in this country are largely Labour and SNP voters. So that in a way, there might be just a large enough political coalition to do something about this now. But the moment they start, there'll be trouble, right? Because now the bulldozers appear, now people see the green fields and the benefits won't appear, and this is a classic prosperity trap problem, till the end of Keir Starmer's first term, if they do at all. And the other quick thing I'll just allude to is you mentioned, you know, the taxation, the sort of benefits of, you know, we have all of this wealth that's untaxed, that is windfall, and, you know, we all pay very high rates of income tax at the moment. And again, that seems unfair to many people. I bet the Labour Party will want to do something about it, and I would caution them, because in the other academic work I've done looking at attitudes towards taxation, the two taxes that British people find most unfair are inheritance tax and stamp duty, both of which are obviously largely property taxes. And the taxes they think are fairest are income tax and national insurance. So yes, it might seem unfair in a progressive sense, but when you ask people about taxes, they still don't like taxing wealth. And I think at the end of the day, people have very strong attitudes against what they perceive to be double taxation. And so it's unfortunate, but I don't think there's a solution to the property crisis in the UK that just comes from taxing property, because that leads to a new set of political concerns. And so I think there'll have to be some softly here. The final thing I'd say, if I was advising Keir Starmer, I'd say, look, all of the answers that people give about why they don't like building houses, the only three people out of 3,000 referred to immigration, so don't worry about that, well, you can worry about that, but not for this reason. Doctors, dentists, schools, roads, infrastructure. Those are the words that people use. So if you want to build houses, you need to promise, with the other hand, capital investment in our public infrastructure. In fact, the sneaky way of doing it would be to say, I am going to build a whole bunch of public infrastructure for the country. By the way, I'm going to build some new houses. Right, get it that way, because that's what people really seem to care about. And that's what makes them nervous about building houses.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, let's hope he listens to this podcast. If he doesn't, he should.
Ben, certainly should.
We've run out of time, I'm afraid. But thank you so much. Just listeners, do read the book and do go to the Substack.
Yeah, I'll wave it one more time.
No one will see this video, but wave it if you like.
No, it's a shame. Your listeners know it exists.
Thank you so much for that. We could have gone for ages, and it's been really, really interesting. So thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Anand. Yes, I hope we resolve the British housing crisis, but if we don't, I'm happy to write for UKICE about it.
Thank you.
Cheers.